When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Mini Break, your daily podcast for the biggest storylines, results, and controversies from the tennis world. Today is Monday, April 1st. The 2024 Miami Open is now officially in the books. With its conclusion comes not only the end of the Sunshine Swing. That's right, tennis fans. With the 2024 Miami Open now completed, we've officially reached the ending of the first third of this 2024 season. That's crazy to say out loud. It feels like we were in Melbourne just last week, but we've now seen a significant sample size of 2024 tennis for us to analyze, and certainly that will be the theme of this week. Yes, I will spend time talking about the active tour level events because, as we all know, the tennis world never sleeps. We have already begun the 2024 clay court season, but later on this week, as we do now have a significant sample size of tennis to analyze, I want to do precisely that for all of you tennis fans, or with, I should say, all of you tennis fans. I want to break down my biggest takeaways from the first third of the year. We'll offer some report cards. We'll, of course, offer out some awards. We'll talk about our biggest questions remaining for the season moving forward. And certainly those sound like conversations best served with guests. So I will try to line up guests accordingly for each of those podcasts. But it's just worth reminding all of you tennis fans here at the start of today's show that with the Sunshine Swing's conclusion comes the start of the clay court season, and dare I say, the flipping to the next chapter of this 2024 year. Now, again, we'll focus on that first third, reflecting upon it later on this week. On today's show, let's talk about how that first third wrapped up. I want to offer my thoughts on everything we saw semifinals onwards in singles at this 2024 Miami Open. Of course, on today's podcast in particular, I want to focus on the headlines. One can legitimately ask the question now, is Jannik Sinner the best men's tennis player in the world? It hasn't just been his start to this 2024 season, which of course features titles now in what, the Australian Open, Rotterdam, now obviously here in Miami, a run at Indian Wells to the semifinals before losing to Alcaraz as well. It doesn't just feature all of that. It features his run to the Tour Finals. It features, what, three victories over Novak Djokovic in his last four matches. It features a run to a Davis Cup title with Italy. It features that title run in Beijing, Vienna, where, you know, in Beijing in particular, he beat Alcaraz, Medvedev back-to-back on his way to that title. The numbers say it, the eye test say it, the consistency of results say it. Again, every statistic screams it. The number one player in the world conversation as it relates to the men's side, I don't think it's been this interesting since before the Big Three era began. Now, that's not to dismiss how much fun we all had dissecting who's the best player in the world right now. Is it Federer? Is it Rafa? Is it Novak? There was even a moment there, 2012 to 2016, where there were times when you would say, is it Andy Murray? But anyways, like, again, we certainly had a lot of fun dissecting the Big Three. We will continue to have fun doing it as historians of the sport. Big Three debates will last forever, as good debates do, as all greatest of all time debates do, I suppose, in any sport. But, you know, again, the world number one race, which, by the way, still features Novak Djokovic very thoroughly as a part of it, it just feels open and renewed in a way it hasn't throughout the course of this Big Three era, because even when guys made their runs, you always knew in the back was a Federer, was a Nadal, was a Djokovic looming. And obviously, Novak still certainly looms. If Rafa makes a comeback at Roland Garros, you just can't throw him out because of the respect you have to have for him in those conditions at that event. But again, this is something I will have a discussion with other podcast guests throughout the course of the week, particularly as we reflect at the first third. But again, as you looked at what Jannik Sinner did this weekend to beat Daniil Medvedev in the fashion that he did, to beat a Grigor Dimitrov, who I still thought in the final, was he quite as electric as he was against Alcaraz in the quarters? No, it wasn't that level. He wasn't taking returns inside the baseline and halfway between baseline and service line on the rise and ripping winners at will, but Dimitrov was still playing very consistent tennis, and it's just the way Jannik Sinner takes everything away from you, the way he finds short angles and then powers through the court through those short angles. You're just not supposed to be able to work the geometry of a court the way Sinner does, and to do it with those long limbs flying all over the place as well. Again, obviously, you come out of this weekend, how could you not be ecstatic about everything Jannik Sinner has done? Not just over the course of the weekend in Miami, but it just felt like, again, this was the feather in the cap of he is the standout player of the first third of the season. And again, he was the signature storyline. Regardless, you know, Danielle Collins' run, and obviously I want to talk about here on today's show, was remarkable for someone who starts the season. Yeah, she played Iga really tight in Australia, but she lost early in all of her events in Australia. And to go from there to what she has now been over the course of these first 3 months of the year for a player who said, hey, this is my last season, to seem to be able to go out playing her best tennis, that's the sort of stuff you dream of. And again, Danielle Collins is a remarkable story. I want to talk all about how she outpowered Rybakina in the final. I want to talk about how she outline-drived Alexandrova in the semifinals. We got plenty of Danielle Collins to reflect upon here on today's show, but to get back to it, Jannik Sinner's the storyline. Like, again, when was the last time someone not named, excluding Andy Murray, someone not named Djokovic, Nadal, or Federer felt like the legitimate world number one? Even when Alcaraz made his rise and Medvedev was at world number one last year, just felt like Djokovic was omnipresent, dare I say, in a way that right now, given his start to the season, he just feels a little bit more vulnerable. Anyways, it's a really fun conversation to have. And in the tennis barbershop that I imagine exists somewhere in the world, or in reality, it's in the tennis pro shop, not the barbershop. I guess that's where we meet up and hang out. Not really in the tennis shop. It's more like wherever the drinking fountain is, and there's always like a drinking fountain couch and one TV setup in every tennis club across the United States. Like, they're just, that setup exists. You know exactly right now. Think of your home club. There's a little lobby area isn't the right way, because the lobby area with the desk where you check in, make sure the court time is good, that's a separate area. No, there's a separate area by the courts where there's like some sort of bench, some sort of seating arrangement. It's at those tables across the tennis world right now, whatever your language of choice may be, where I imagine you're having this debate and talking about this with your tennis friends, certainly on bus rides and whatever. If you're on high school teams, I like to think those discussions are happening right now. So that's the signature storyline. And by the way, with how handsome he is, with his, like, he's the veteran right now who's been a little bit long around a little bit longer. Like, I bet Grigor is getting in those discussions as well. Did you see him against Alcaraz? Did you see him get over the Zverev mountaintop? Do you see how well he's playing? I've been making this case for 9 months now that this Dimitrov is actually the best version of Grigor Dimitrov. And we can get into the statistical argument, I suppose, of that a little bit on today's show. I know I've done that segment a bunch of times of late, but we'll do that one more time here today and break down Medvedev, Zverev, again, the other actors over the course of the weekend, Rybakina, Alexandrova, who did Victoria Azarenka. There's still plenty of other little things for us to touch on as we wrap up our Miami Open coverage. So I want to do all that here on today's show. I feel like I've already started doing that in this introduction, which just shows we're back here on the Mini Break podcast feed. Of course, we're active in a couple of other places right now here at Cracked Rackets. Our coverage of all things happening the 2024 college tennis season, available over on the Great Shot podcast feed or live on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel. Of course, you can watch our GSP recap shows every week, Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern time. We talk about the Division I women's action. Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern time, we talk about the men's action. Do you want to know who the next Danielle Collins emerging from the college tennis world world might be. Now, right now, it feels like it's her fellow, former Virginia Cavalier and NCAA singles champion Emma Navarro. And by the way, those UVA women, they got a big win over number 10 NC State at home this past Thursday. They are currently a top five team in the country. You want to learn more about who those next players might be? Come check out our coverage of everything happening in the college tennis world. We've got broadcasts available on ESPN Plus every Thursday, Friday, Sunday on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel as well every Sunday. So perhaps I have finally convinced you, or Danielle Collins' success has finally convinced you, to dip your toes into the college tennis world. Just see what's going on. Again, get a whiff of what's happening at that level. We can certainly help you do that here at Cracked Rackets with our coverage of everything happening there. Again, whether it's the Great Shot podcast feed, Cracked Interviews feed, make sure you don't miss out on any of our content. Make sure you do go give the college tennis world a look. Of course, also, just want to bring to all of your attention some really fun conversations coming on the Cracked Interviews podcast feed, so be on the lookout there. And then we're going to bring this mini break back onto our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel as well. I will ask each of our guests if they'll be willing to go live with me on YouTube for those shows. If we do go live, look for that announcement on our various social media channels, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, at Cracked Rackets, or from me at AL Gruskin on Twitter as well. Of course, a thank you to you listeners for tuning in, and a thank you as always to the support we get from our dear friends at Tennis Point. Remember, it's tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR15 for all of the latest and greatest products in the tennis world. With all of that said, let's talk Miami Open Championship weekend. Let's start on the men's side of things. I know, ladies first, I was raised that chivalry matters, and I apologize for switching the order up on all of you listeners here today, but did you hear my 7 minutes in the intro on why I think Jannik Sinner is the best player in the world right now? Again, the numbers speak for themselves. You look for Jannik Sinner to start this 2024 season a ridiculous 22-1. 22-1 overall to start the year. His one loss, of course, his three-set loss to Alcaraz in the Indian Wells semifinals. He's won Australia, Rotterdam, now Miami, and an Indian Wells semifinal to boot. So he's played a slam. He won it. 500. He won it. Indian Wells semifinaled it. Now he's won Miami as well. Again, the time span I like to turn to, though, is it's been a full year, or at least 9 months, now three quarters of a year for Jannik Sinner, and the pace of what he's on to do over the course of a 52-week stretch from Wimbledon last year to, dare I say, Wimbledon this year. It might legitimately, like, if he wins the French Open, wins one of the French Open or Wimbledon, I don't know if it's a Mount Rushmore-level season. But it would start to be in that, okay, where does this 52-week time span rank with the best 52-week time spans of some of the all-time greats? Like, you really would want to start pulling up maybe the Lendl numbers, maybe the best Agassi season numbers, maybe even the best Pistol Pete numbers. Now, again, he's a slam away from really putting himself in that tier of the conversation, but you look for him since the start of Wimbledon last year, 54-6. 54-6 overall, not just 22-1 to start this year, 54-6 overall during that span. He's played 13 different events. He's made the quarterfinals of, he's played 13 different events, but one of them's the tour finals, so of course he made it directly to the semifinals there. Still, we'll say semifinals then, because he's 8-0 in quarters. At the 13 events he's played, he's made the semifinals or further at 9 of them. He's made the finals at 7 of the 13, and he's won titles at 6 of the 13. But because that 50%, winning 50% of your events over a 52-week stretch, that's when you start to get into the Mount Pantheon discussion. That's what 06-07 Federer was doing. That's what 2010-11-ish range Rafa was doing. That's certainly, I mean, you can point to a couple of Djokovic seasons, which is why statistically he has put the greatest of all time discussion to bed. Statistically, I'm saying. Again, if you throw in that Davis Cup title, which should be thrown in for Jannik Sinner, given he beat Djokovic on his way to that, in helping Italy to that title, he's won 7 of 14 events like that he's played over the last 9 months, excuse me. That's remarkable. And again, it's the level of competition as well. Against top 20 opponents during this time span, he's 23-5 overall. Against the top 10, he's 13-3 overall. He's, by the way, first in hold percentage and second in break percentage over his last 52 weeks of play. The top one group is an elusive group. Only one player can be in the top one group. And right now, Iga Swiatek lives in the top one group by herself, lonely on the women's side. She almost had top one club companionship. Like, that's how good Jannik Sinner. He's a few percentage points behind, which is a lot in terms of breakups of serve. He's probably like a three breaks in... No, that's not. I got to scale that. He probably needs to break serve 9 times in his next 33 return games to get to where Carlos Alcaraz is at that number one spot, flirting with a 30% break percentage. Sinner right now over the last 52 weeks, currently sitting at a 28.7% break percentage, so about 1.3% behind. But again, we're talking about someone, okay, he's not number one, he's number two in break percentage, and just watching him on serve in particular, like, he is the best server in the world right now, and it's not the serve itself, it's everything he does behind the serve. Every plus one shot is available to him, whether it's, and you saw them employed, by the way, throughout the course of the weekend, whether it was in the 3-1 win over Dimitrov, where how many break points did he face? Oh, he faced one break point during that match. What about in the semifinals against Daniil Medvedev, a match, by the way, he won 1-2. Oh, he faced 3 break points against a guy who is certainly one of the 5 best returners on a hard court we have on tour. Faced just 3 break points. Won that match 1-2 in 1 hour and 9 minutes. And that honestly is a disservice to how one way that match was. Like, it wasn't 1 hour 9 minutes. That match was over in the first 30 minutes. There was just nothing Daniil Medvedev could do to hurt Jannik Sinner, and how well Sinner is moving, the fluidity, you know, how well he hits on the move now in the outer thirds, the depth he's able to generate on his on-the-run forehand. I've said this before in the past, now that RBA is certainly past his prime, I think Grigor Dimitrov has the best running forehand of the mortals on the ATP Tour because, you know, again, Djokovic, whatever, all those guys in a different category. The way Dimitrov baits you into challenging his on-the-run forehand, you know, he hits the backhand slice, cross, you think you have more time than you do to redirect and take down the line and take an aggressive cut, but then he's there and he beats you to the spot with the forehand cross, and now you're the one all out of sorts, you're the one having to hit on the sprint. Jannik Sinner was better at the on-the-run forehand than Grigor Dimitrov was in that final, and it just felt like Sinner was so patient, and this was something he did in the Medvedev match as well. He wasn't as aggressive moving forward as he was at the end of last year when they faced off, or certainly sets 3, 4, 5 in their Australian Open encounter. No. But Sinner was very patient in attacking the Medvedev backhand wing. You know, again, baiting Daniil Medvedev, saying, you know, create something, do something special, try to take a big cut forehand cross, because Sinner was betting that Medvedev couldn't penetrate the court well enough on that forehand cross to make Jannik uncomfortable. That's how well he's moving in and out of corners. That's the sort of depth, pace he's able to generate. And then when he does make you uncomfortable, now you pop something up. Again, he's moving forward so successfully. He's so confident, so fluid in doing all of those things. Can attack backhand line, can attack forehand line, backhand cross, hit through the court doing those things. The most ridiculous shot right now in Jannik Sinner's arsenal is that short angle forehand that everyone else has to hit as a slow roller, right? If you're trying to hit an angle that precise, you got to bring out the protractor for it. Typically, you got to reduce how much pace you hit that angle with. Certainly not reduce your racket speed, but that ball isn't going to go through the court as quickly. It's just not the case for Jannik Sinner. Like, he finds that short angle and still manages to keep things somewhat flat so it's moving through the court with such trajectory. And again, his patience with the Grigor Dimitrov backhand slice, saying, no, I'll keep playing cross. Like, I'm fine with that. I don't care if you flatten line. I think he's going to be okay there. Or just waiting for the exact right ball to attack behind, to get in behind again. Medvedev just had no answers in that match. Tried to return 15 feet behind the baseline, tried taking the return a little bit earlier, tried rushing Sinner. None of it worked. And just, you know, same thing with Dimitrov. Every backhand slice was the kiss of death because that's how well Sinner is hitting through the court right now. The angles he's going to generate for himself, you just can't give him time. He dropped one set on his way to this Miami Open title. And just, you know, again, 22-1 to start the year. The one loss is a 3-set loss to Alcaraz in the Indian Wells semifinal. First Italian men to ever be ranked number 2 in the ATP singles rankings. Obviously, new career high for him, up to the number 2 spot. He could, I'm not going to say should, but he could legitimately be the world number 1 right now. And obviously, he's number 1 in the points race through the first third of 2024. But I mean, just look at his success during this time span. You know, I mentioned the 13-3 record against top 10 opponents. He's what, 1-1 against Alcaraz during this time, but he's now 5-0 against Daniil Medvedev. He's lost twice to Djokovic, but he's beaten him three times as well. So he's what, 5-0 against Medvedev, 1-1 against Alcaraz, 3-2 against Novak Djokovic. Like, okay, again, that what more could you ask for over a 9-month stretch? 1-1 with Alcaraz, 3-2 against Djokovic, 5-0 against Medvedev. That's the big one that stands out to me. Medvedev right now has a serious Jannik Sinner problem because Jannik is just there physically now, and you know, because he knows that his legs will be underneath him, it just allows him to get into his entire arsenal. And the way he can out finesse you, the way he can take the return on the rise, the way he can take it as a bullet and just minimize your plus one opportunities, the way he can kind of take away the first thing you want to do as well and disrupt it with his power. And then he's got a counter really for everything as well. Can hit the slice well, as I said, gets outside the ball so well. Such a complete player for a 22-year-old. And I know I discussed this with Gil Gross last week of who do I think can continue to improve more moving forward, Sinner or Alcaraz. And Gil made the case for Alcaraz because he thinks tennis-wise he's a little bit less complete than Sinner right now. And I did think that was a good argument to make. But again, you just feel like with every millisecond of time Sinner adds to the time that he gives himself by getting quicker, it's just there's not a weakness, a clear-cut vulnerability to attack. I mean, sure, a second serve might sit up everyone. Second serve sits up from time to time. But, you know, he's willing to slow things down. He's willing to hit his three-quarter pace ball to set up an opportunity to flatten something out in a way that sometimes I just don't think Alcaraz is willing to. Like, for instance, in that quarterfinal against Grigor, you know, for Alcaraz, it wasn't get back to the basics of find the backhand corner and bait, you know, play 9,000 consecutive shots through there, force Dimitrov to... I know there are times... I mean, look, Dimitrov won. That's a bad example, but again, Alcaraz tries to out-hit you. He tries to hit himself out of every problem, tries to maximize the winners and just maximize the aggression and just overwhelm you, even when he's down, as opposed to buying himself time. Now, Jannik Sinner was never down in this event, so we didn't need to see him hit that gear, but it was the patience he displayed against Dimitrov and Medvedev. Everything was working for the 22-year-old. Is he the best player in the world right now? Some scholars would legitimately argue yes. Again, 22-1 to start 2024, 54-6 now since the start of last year's Wimbledon, 9 semifinals or further in 13 events, or 10-14 if you want to include Davis Cup, 7 titles in 14 events if you include Davis Cup as well. Come on. Like, he's 7-1 in finals, by the way, and that one loss was in the tour finals to Djokovic at an event where, by the way, he had already beaten Novak Djokovic in group play. 5-0 against Medvedev, 3-2 against Djokovic, 1-1 against Alcaraz. That's a resume, and he has a slam title and a couple of 1,000-level titles under his belt as well. That is a world number one resume through 9 months. And again, if the clay court season, if he sustains this level, now we're talking about a Pantheon level 52-week run for a guy who's still just 22 years old, turns 23 in August. Now you start to elevate Jannik Sinner in the not necessarily, it's probably still a little bit too late. And, you know, again, that he's going to have the roadblock in Carlos Alcaraz that a bunch of other factors still playing. I don't know if I'm willing to eliminate him from the greatest of all time discussion in that hypothetical fun we like to have. But like 8 slams, 9 slams, a top 10 men's tennis player of all time. Like, he's certainly not eliminated from that discussion in terms of the pathway he is on. And the most exciting part is it's just very clear that this feels sustainable. It doesn't feel out of character, out of body. It feels like we are now in the midst of the Jannik Sinner. You know, the great ones go on 5 to 7 year runs. The Pantheon guys make it 10 years. We're at the start of that sort of stretch for Sinner. And is it going to be a 3-year run, more Courier-esque? Is it going to be a 5 to 7 year run? Again, that second tier Borg and McEnroe and Sampras and Agassi, etc. Again, can he start to flirt with that final tier? Like, and really push towards double-digit slams. I'm not ready to have that conversation yet. Let's not go crazy, although, again, with his consistency at the majors, really since the start of 2022, where he's just a shoo-in to second weeks and quarterfinals and all these different things now, you feel like moving forward. Again, this is the best part of getting my job, is when you get to pontificate and hypothesize about these really outlandish but fun hypotheticals moving forward. And it does feel like Sinner has opened the door for all of those fun hypotheticals. And again, how complete of a player he is tactically. And he may look like a string bean, but that guy, how he slides in and out of corners. I don't know how his kneecap doesn't snap, but credit to him, man, playing elite tennis. So is 32-year-old Grigor Dimitrov, by the way. He turns 33 in May, but you look for Dimitrov now. Since the start of Geneva last year, which was the final he made the week before the French Open. So essentially 10 months now for Grigor Dimitrov, 51-17. Overall, what's the best 52-week time span Grigor Dimitrov's had in his career? I'm glad you asked, everyone. Went 50-17 in 2014. It's 51-17 now. So hashtag one more win for all of you doubters out there. Now in 2017, when he won the tour finals, he went 49-19 overall. His numbers statistically, the best they've ever been. 86.7% hold percentage, 23.7% break percentage. If you want to say the level of competition was higher in 2017 than now, thus that's more impressive than his 2023-4 season. That's an argument I'm willing to entertain. I think that's a very fair discussion to have. But man, the numbers speak for themselves. Like, Grigor Dimitrov is holding 87% of the time now since May 22nd of last year. That's a career high over a 10.5-month span. He's breaking serve 23.1% of the time. Again, as I mentioned, that number for him in 2014 was 22.4. In 2017, his number was 23.7 in terms of break percentage. 23.1 is right in between the two. And if you watched his returning display in the quarterfinals, I mean, the level he showed against Alcaraz, that has to be the best match he's ever played, right? Just to be broken once in that match, to 2-4 Carlos, and to be up a set and a break, see that break back to Carlos, but then still get the break to finish things in two sets. And again, there was an on-the-rise, inside-out, one-handed backhand return he hit on the deuce side. Just laws of physics. Like, if Isaac Newton saw that shot, Grigor would have been burned as a witch. Like, because he just would have been like, sorry. I mean, not that Newton, they would have been like, Newton, shut up, you're a witch. But again, like, if it was the wrong, you know, again, if it was the wrong half of the town in Salem, and there were some trials going on the other side, and they'd be like, ooh, like, this Grigor guy might actually be a wizard as well. Maybe he should, again, let's indict him on something. It's just the movement. I've said this now for 9 months. I think that's the biggest piece. He's just back as a mover, and he's healthy, and he's fit, and he's confident, and every step he picks is the exact right step. And how well he's hitting his forehand inside out, forehand line from that ad corner, how easy it is for him to find that side corners. Again, like, wasn't broken against Zverev in his 6-4, 6-7, 6-4 win in that match. And that's the whole thing for me, is like, get to 4-all with Zverev, and you know he's going to give you some free stuff, right? You know he'll mix in a double fault. You know he's going to play very tentatively 6 to 7 feet, you know, 6 or more feet behind the baseline. And Dimitrov took advantage of that fact. Again, how well he rushed forward, how quickly he got off to that break lead in Alcaraz. Went up 2-0, like right off the bat, and was taking returns inside the baseline, short hopping them on the rise. I mean, the redrops, the touch at the net, how confident he is moving forward. He's just moving better at everything. There's a reason the numbers look like they do. It's because everything is in rhythm. Everything is going right now to script for Grigor Dimitrov. And that's when he's always, you know, again, no one has ever questioned his ability to strike the ball, or, you know, sometimes it was the improvisational skills. Like, as amazing as he looked on the run, when you could get his forehand out of the strike zone, it would spray on him. Again, he comes over the top of the backhand now with strength, with power, with confidence, better than he ever did in the past. So, man, credit to Grigor. He's playing elite ball. Obviously, he makes his return to the top 10 for the first time in about half a decade. Dimitrov now back up to number 8 in the live rankings this week. I mean, like, Casper Ruud down 2 points, I should say. I think Dimitrov right now is technically 10 in the PIFs or the ATP rankings, whatever we want to call them. But An Esterol run for Ruud comes off his rankings this week, so he's down to 10. Hurkacz actually up to 9. Dimitrov up to 8 in the live rankings as such. So, excuse me, Dimitrov, I think, is at 9 this week. He's 6 in the points race to start this year. And, you know, again, you look for Grigor. I mentioned the big time span, but 2024, he's 20-5 overall. He's holding serve 90.3% of the time. His losses so far this year are what? Sinner, Medvedev, Demonauer, Umber in a final. And then the weird one to Nuno Borges in the round of 32. But hey, we're an NDN crew. We never doubt Nuno here. So it's just all working for Grigor. I've been making the case that he's a top eight guy for 6 months. And now the rankings say he's a top eight guy. Certainly tennis abstracts, ELO ratings think even higher of him right now. He's 5th in overall ELO, 3rd in 2024 specific ELO ratings. Magnificent, you know, again, playing the best tennis of his career. And it was really cool to see, like, Serena Williams out supporting him. Like, again, there's some star power, some cachet for Grigor, the goodwill he's built up over the years. And again, given all the injuries, all the stuff that's happened to him through this COVID era, it's great to see him come out of this now 4 years later, still playing, again, the best tennis of, dare I say, anyone still around in his generation. And the ranking next to his number certainly reflects that fact. In terms of the semifinalists, Medvedev has a Sinner problem. Like, first, you've lost 5 in a row to Jannik Sinner, and obviously was up 2 sets to love in Australia, so that one stings in particular. But it's just, again, physically, Sinner doesn't wear down the way he once did in those matchups. His backhand doesn't break down in the way he did in those matchups. The return of serve, he just can hold his ground a little bit better on that spot. And again, there hasn't been other than Medvedev taking his return of serve a little bit earlier, there hasn't been an adjustment clearly. And, you know, again, I think this really comes down to is sometimes Medvedev does have opportunities at the net to finish things out. And Medvedev is the king of, he's the best bad volleyer I know, in the sense that sometimes he comes up with these ridiculous flick of the wrist, and that just speaks to his coordination and his innate sense and improvisational skills on the court. But sometimes you'll jam him with an easy volley, and that's the one he floats back to you and gives you another look at a pass, or, again, just doesn't do enough with that first volley, and now you're back into the point, and, man, Sinner made him pay for all of those in their semifinal matchup. You know, again, his first serve usually can win him free points. It really just didn't against Sinner, and, again, Sinner was just so good in that semifinal. A lot of that had more to do with Sinner's upside than it did with Medvedev, but he's got a Jannik Sinner problem, and, you know, again, I want to look at that match more closely once again. I want to give it a rewatch. I want to watch it in contrast with the Australian Open final as well to just kind of give it a gander of just what can he do tactically? What adjustments are even available to him from a pattern sense? I'm going to try and get a big brain on to have that discussion because I think it would be fascinating. For Zverev, look, he comes out of the sunshine swing in first third of the season, 5 in the world. There's no, you can't give his, I know he doesn't have a title yet this year. I know he lost, what, semis Australia, should have beaten Medvedev. Quarters, got blown out by Alcaraz. You know, again, a little shaky at the end of that first set, which he probably should have won, and that's why he ends up losing to Grigor in 3. But he's back to 5 in the world, like, just back in the mix, back in the conversation, back in the final rounds of, you know, again, of the 3 significant events, 4 if you want to include United Cup. Finals of United Cup, semis of Australia, quarters of Indian Wells, semis of Miami. Surface level, it can't be lower than a B+, certainly for the Sasha Zverev season, and he's just back in the mix. Like, yeah, the same problems are there. He's just back to being Sasha Zverev. It's the same conversation we've had for more than half a decade now. He's back to having that conversation after, obviously, was removed from the 2022 season after that ankle injury, and back up to number 5 in the rankings, comes out of the first third, 3 in the points race as well, though again, no titles for him that first third of the season. Certainly there were some opportunities for him on the board, some things he left out there. You know, that's everything from a storyline perspective on the men's side. I think I talked enough last week about Jarry, about Mahach, about Fabian Marajan, who obviously were all quarterfinalists at this event. Shout out to our final quarterfinalist as well, Carlos Alcaraz, who I mean, the way he won Indian Wells, with how well he was playing. Again, the story of that quarterfinal match wasn't anything going wrong with Alcaraz. It was how sensational Grigor Dimitrov was in that match, taking everything, short hopping, etc. So credit to Dimitrov, who knocked out Alcaraz, prevented him from stealing the Sunshine Swing. Still, I'm sure everyone is buying stock in Carlos Alcaraz as we head towards the clay court season, which I always thought would be the surface he's best at, and yet the big result so far, Wimbledon title, U.S. Open title. Obviously, there have been some clay court 1000 level successes, but still waiting for that signature French Open run from Alcaraz. Thought he almost had it last year with everything setting up with Djokovic, but we know how that semifinal ended, and obviously, I'm very much looking forward to seeing how he performs in this next third of the year. Anyways, that's everything from the women's from the men's side. Excuse me. I will not be spending quite as long on breaking down the women's side. I do think their first third of the season on the WTA Tour was maybe more probably more fascinating. I think we have more clarity now at the time. Let me rephrase that. The first third of the ATP season was probably more revealing than the first third of the WTA season, but I actually think the next two-thirds of the WTA season are far more fascinating because I still have so many more questions about the hierarchy right now on the WTA Tour, and I think this was another injection of doubt offered to us by this 2024 Miami Open run. Now, certainly, again, Elena Rybakina sent a sharp reminder that when healthy, particularly on a hard court, she's a tier one player. And to see her, you know, not play her best tennis and yet still reach that final to be pushed to three sets against who? Tosin, Townsend, Sakkari, and Azarenka. Like, it's a testament to her willpower and a testament to the different gears she has developed in her game that she was able to reach the final. But the story of the week and the story of the tournament is unequivocally Danielle Collins, who, you know, 31 years old, this is just her third tour-level title of her career. She won Palermo in 2021, San Jose in 2021. Oh, excuse me, Newport Beach, I suppose, in 2018. I don't remember if that was what level of event that was, if it was a 125 or a 250, but you know, this is the biggest title of her career, and it comes in her final season of her career. And she dropped just one set on her way to this title, came all the way back against Bernarda Pera in round number one. It was her first set of the tournament, so she won, what, 14 consecutive sets to win the event and was pushed to 6-4 or further only once after that first round, again, coming in that final in that first set, a 7-5, 6-3 set taken by Collins. Now, Rybakina had a lot of opportunities, you know, in the game prior to where she was broken in the second set, in the game prior to where she was broken in the first set, in each of those subsequent Collins service games, she had breakpoint chances to break and try and close out each of those sets. And you just have to wonder mentally that she was unable to close them out, that, you know, again, she had to deal with the Collins roar when you come back, and just mentally to deal with Collins, the competitor. I can only imagine that challenge, what that's like. And I mean that in the most respectful way to Danielle Collins. You can feel her intensity. I always call it main character energy. There's just an intensity for Danielle Collins that if you're not ready to match on that day and she has it in spades, she can just overwhelm you with all of it. And just, again, how well she was hitting the backhand cross. Come on now, Danielle. The ruthlessness which she was taking cuts whenever she had the chance on her return of serve. Just, I was really impressed. Again, throughout the course of the week, the most impressive was the 3-2 over Alexandrova. Just like the way Alexandrova took the ball off Swiatek's racket. That's exactly what Collins did to Alexandrova in the semifinals. In the finals, you know, again, Rybakina is going to hit her first serve. She's going to hit her first strike. She's going to have her moments where she hits her spots. And for the most part, you know, she still was able to do that with some success. But Collins was the more dynamic of the two when things broke down from the scripted structure each wanted to provide to the point. And again, Collins out of the backhand corner just all week long. You didn't know if she was going to go line. You didn't know if she was going to go cross. You were afraid on both. How well Collins was ripping the on-the-run, short-angle, forehand, cross-court pass. Like, you can make a highlight reel probably into a TikTok-length video of like 9 to 10 of them over the course of championship weekend alone. It's such a feel-good moment for, again, a player who has dealt with so many different injuries. We've always known what the ceiling is. Daniel Collins is a slam finalist, like with another slam semifinal to her resume as well. Someone who has made deep runs at big events before, and yet again, whether it's health, just whatever it may be, there have been things that had prevented Collins from having this long runway of success. I mean, she's been ranked as high as number 7 in the world, so that's been plenty of success, but the long runway of maybe top 20 tennis you thought she was capable of, we never really saw that for a 52-week mark. I'll tell you what, she's not 20-7 now to start her 2024 season. Obviously, it was a little bit of a slower start, but you know, since that Australian Open loss to Iga, where she really should have pulled through in that second round match, the losses are to Iga, Rybakina in the round of 16, a 3-set loss in Abu Dhabi. 5-4, she lost to Pavlyuchenkova as a qualifier in Doha, so she had to play 5 matches before that, and Pavs has been a top 20 player this year, no shame in that. Has to retire in the Wang Shiyu quarterfinal in Austin, so you throw that out. Loses to Iga, 3-0 at Indian Wells, but as I've said, the first 6 games were as tightly as Iga has probably pushed that entire Indian Wells, and now she's a Miami champion. She right now, back up to number 22 in the live rankings, 7th in the points race right now. I mean, she's got a 1,000 level, and it's only been 3 months, but it feels about right. Like, again, the peak level is still very much there for Danielle Collins. How healthy can she remain the rest of the season? That's the big question, because it does feel like mentally there's just some freedom with knowing the finish line is at the end, with knowing, okay, like, the joy that comes with getting to do all these things for the final time, practice and all those morning stretching sessions, all those little things become a little bit less annoying because you do know the finish line is in sight, and so you perhaps take the time to enjoy them a little bit more. This isn't Collins-centric analysis. This is any human-centric analysis. The joy you could see on her face after winning this title as well, what it meant to her, just the freedom with which she's playing. It's what you aspire to as an athlete, and boy, was it remarkable to see. Now, again, on the Rybakina note, I don't think she served her best all week. Like, she was under 60% first serve percentage, I think, in 5 of her 6 matches that she played. The only one she wasn't, I think, the Madison Keys match. I thought the backhand was working well, but again, like, I thought her forehand on the run was a little bit leaky in this Collins match. I thought Collins won their cross-court exchanges. I thought Collins was the better returner. Just, again, Rybakina is still a little bit too much one speed on the return at times, or at least that's where that can get her into trouble, where at times you just feel like, just put this return deep down the center, and then the next ball you're going to get the forehand you're looking for, and instead she goes for the kill shot with that return, whether it's, you know, again, how well she hits the inside-out backhand on the deuce side. You're not supposed to have that strength to hit it as fluidly as she does, but, you know, again, I think for Rybakina, coming off of, you know, again, an Indian Wells she had to pull out of, you look at her first third of the season, 22-3 overall on the year. You know, the losses are what? 22-4, excuse me, overall on the year. The losses are to Iga in the Doha final. The weird loss to Blinkova, obviously, in that Australian Open round 2. An Alexandrova quarterfinal loss in Adelaide, a match that never should have happened. And now this final loss to Danielle Collins. She's gone title in Brisbane, title in Abu Dhabi, finals Doha, final Miami, and then the weird Australian Open run. I think she's made up for that lack of Melbourne-specific success. And I think she's pretty clearly the third or fourth best player in the world right now. Now, again, I think Iga's 1, Sabalenka 2. I think the consistency of Goff, let me put it like this. The consistency of Goff is better match in, match out. The ceiling of Rybakina is higher. I think Rybakina's best is better than Goff's best right now. And so I would probably put her at 3 in my personal power rankings. As we reflect on the first third, I suppose I'll answer that question. But it's pretty unequivocal she's a tier 1 player on hard courts, and the results certainly say as much. She's now 48-13. 79% win percentage over her last 52 weeks, number 2 in hold percentage, trailing only Iga Swiatek. Yeah, I think Rybakina's feeling pretty good about herself coming out of Miami, and so are the other semifinalists. Vika back up to 26 in the rankings. Ekat up to her career high now in the rankings of 15. I mean, again, Collins just out Ekat in that semifinal. Rybakina just had a little bit too much oomph for Azarenka down the home stretch, and yet Did you watch how Vika fought back to take that 6 love-second set? Did you watch her break back in the third set? The fire, the passion, intensity she plays with. The 34-year-old still got it. Like, still very, very. This was the first run where, again, the statistics, the metrics, I've all loved Vika for 2 years consecutively, even if the big results and the eye-popping runs haven't been there. This was one for Vika, and a little reminder of what that ceiling remains for the former world number one. But again, that's everything from championship weekend at the 2024 Miami Open. Now, we still have a lot of reflecting to do on the first third of the year, and that will be one of the prevailing themes of this week's podcast. Of course, we will also have coverage of this week's tour level action as we begin the transition to the clay court season. I know we've got action in Charleston, Bogota, and I think one other on the women's side. For the men, they're in Estoril, Houston, and I want to say Marrakesh as well. So we're right back in the thick of things. 5, 6 tour-level events. That's how you know the tennis world is still rocking and rolling. Of course, we will be here on this show this week to continue to cover it all. Of course, the reason we're able to do that day in, day out is because of the tireless efforts of our super producer, Daniel Westhoff, who, as always, has a f*** of an editing job to do day in, day out. So shout-out to him. A shout-out as well to the support we get from our dear friends at Tennis Point. Remember, it's tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR15 for all of the latest and greatest products in the tennis world. With that said, for our fantastic super producer Daniel Westhoff, our friends at Tennis Point, from all of us here at both Crack Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, I'm your host Alex Gruskin. You know what we say? That's the break. We'll talk to you all tomorrow. Thanks, everyone.